Hi, and welcome to The Growth System, the podcast that looks at the world of B2B growth through a systems thinking lens. I'm Colin Shakespeare.
And I'm Chris Bayliss.
And in this episode, we're diving into a major organizational trap, which is how companies default to just set and forget processes, particularly when thinking about opportunities for process automation, which is something that we talk about a lot, Chris and I. Because when businesses automate existing workflows without rethinking or redesigning, they risk cementing inefficiencies rather than unlocking the full potential of automation. So using a systems thinking lens, we're going to explore some key patterns that reveal how this issue actually manifests in the real world, and actually provide some real world examples to illustrate the problems and some possible solutions. So, Chris, why do so many organizations fall into this set and forget trap?
Well, I think it's an interesting one. And frankly, there are probably quite a few things going on here as ever. But, you know, let's try and unpack some of them. I guess ultimately, if I had to wrap it up into a single conclusion, it would be that it's a mindset thing. There's a book I really like written by someone we both know, the CEO of one of our tech partners, a business called Wakato. The book's called The New Automation Mindset, which perhaps sort of unsurprisingly, given the title, really digs into that sort of mindset point. To be fair, wrapped with a lot of sort of great automation practice stuff as well. But I think one of the main outtakes from that perspective, at least, is that too many organizations have what they call in the book a task mindset, meaning they spend too much time down in the weeds of the problem and don't kind of zoom out and see the big picture. And of course, I guess, therefore, the big opportunities that you get by having that sort of system view of the world. And I guess to some degree, this is really just complacency. You know, typically, I guess most organizations lack any real impetus for sort of genuine transformation. And I think part of this is because there's inevitably a lot of resistance when it comes to trying to change processes. And I guess that wins out if you don't have that driving force of really needing to deliver change. And yeah, a lot of organizations talk about digital transformation, perhaps a little less so now. I don't know whether that's becoming a slightly unfashionable term, but in reality, the gains that are actually being made are not that significant. I think we've got an interesting perspective on this, actually, because we do a lot of process design and kind of business process automation work. And you would think that we would get a lot of briefs that are about like proper digital transformation. And in the main, we don't, you know, not really. They might say that at the top of the briefing document, but, you know, the main driver of process automation typically is efficiency. And that efficiency is viewed, at least at the start, in a fairly sort of static perspective when it comes to the processes that are being made more efficient. It should be that, you know, what we see as results that are kind of stated as like desirable outcomes in briefs, at least initially, are about doing the same thing faster or with less people, or, you know, simply just connecting point C to point D more efficiently than it was before. And very, very few take a genuinely open-minded view of just how can you do this thing better, which I don't know whether there is a sort of human bias piece there. When people write a brief, they're just sort of compelled to do a version of whatever's there because that's what's easiest or it's obviously apparent, or it doesn't seem like a good brief if you just leave a, you know, could you just do this thing better?
but I guess it's the brief that you, the kind of dream brief here is that they're taking a blank sheet approach. Like if we had a blank sheet of paper and designed it from the ground up, what would it actually look like? But I think in my career, I've seen very, very, very few of those. So not just the time that I've spent working with you, Chris. So maybe it is a human nature thing. But I think actually being told, right, you have a blank sheet of paper, let's reimagine how this business works or this set of processes works, is actually quite a challenging task that involves getting a lot of stakeholders together and having a big argument around a whiteboard for probably a very long time. So I think we start to get to some of the answers as to why this mindset problem exists.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, I think just most companies don't make process design or indeed automation a strategic priority. And I guess when something isn't a priority, it very often lacks ownership within the org. And kind of when it lacks that sort of portfolio responsibility of someone senior, then there isn't necessarily going to be a strategic vision for where they're trying to get to that's actually held by all that's sort of commonly sort of understood. And that's not going to be driving any sort of an agenda. So I guess you get a lot of sort of anchoring into the status quo taking place because people don't necessarily have a remit to do anything else. I think another factor is probably, and you sort of alluded to it a second ago, is that doing things cross-functionally, like cross-functional collaboration around complex things, is not an easy thing to kind of get off the ground. Yeah, we explored this in an episode recently about kind of alignment, really, just multi-team alignment. We were talking about sales and marketing, broadly speaking, but I think it plays out everywhere, is that it isn't easy getting a cross-functional process improvement project off the ground when it isn't a strategic priority being driven from above. And in most cases, I think in reality, it's just actually not going to happen full stop. So you get this kind of inertia to change often, you know, I guess even when a lot of people can probably quite clearly see that something is maybe not broken, but certainly not as good as it could be, and that there's going to be a really clear benefit from a change, but it just doesn't have that ability to gain traction in the organization as a project, and things just therefore stay the same. And I think that inertia, you know, what I'd called earlier complacency, which is perhaps slightly unfair, is really just the driver of that sort of, you know, set and forget. Like, set and forget is a phrase that's almost positioned as a benefit, but in reality, it's sort of, you know, set and try not to look at. I guess I'd probably call out another couple of issues if we're doing the full kind of audit here.
We are.
let's do it. So I would say what's driving this kind of set and forget mindset, and maybe this one particularly applies to automation projects, but simply most organizations don't invest in discovery around processes. They probably, maybe if they're decent, have a review process and like a change log for existing processes or whatever, but that's not discovery. That's not actually doing a proper analysis and answering questions like, what would happen if we just ripped this up and started again? Like, those sort of questions aren't in scope in a change log, in a process optimization process that even a decent business is going to have in place. And most probably don't even have that around a lot of processes unless they're absolutely business critical. So ultimately, just no one's asking the question. In fact, actually, I saw a stat recently published in a study that suggested that 80% of automation opportunities in most orgs remain unidentified, not undelivered, but just simply unidentified. That just no one knows they're there because they haven't gone out and engaged with the right stakeholders and actually challenged some of that established thinking, challenged the status quo, you know, the traditional ways of working, call it what you want. But no one's just had the remit to go in and say, what if? And I think that's a big problem that's actually holding back a lot of organizations when it comes to, you say process transformation, it sounds boring. I mean, to reframe process transformation, they're not looking at how we can make things better for customers, better for staff, more efficient, cheaper, less irritating to deliver. I mean, the tangible benefits of getting big processes right are many and various. And yet it's just seemingly too easy to brush under the carpet, I guess. I know that, you know, from your kind of experience in big automation places, I think you see a lot of these projects too. So I just think that centralized view just doesn't really exist.
No. There's a sort of tension between the priorities of various lines of business. I kind of view the line of business heads as being, it's very easy to do if you live in the west of Scotland, actually. If you imagine a landscape which is a bunch of valleys that are connected at certain points, but mostly aren't. And the line of business heads can see everything that's going on within their valley and maybe certain interconnection points between them and the other valleys. But really, they have their own set of priorities and their own valley, or I guess silos, as we refer to them. And then there's, you know, maybe there's a tension between that and some centralizing drive. But I've seen very little of us, either internally, candidly, or externally, as in projects coming in when I've worked in this space, which is really about a sort of strategic automation mindset. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think in our time working together, there's one organization that we were speaking to, one which had a commitment to really discovering what all the processes in their business actually were. And yeah. This was a huge and messy task, and I don't think it's finished yet, and it's been quite a long time.
Yeah. But no, that's true. And actually, I think that's sort of what some people would call process mining. I think that probably is maybe getting a bit more traction than I gave it credit for, but it's very much in the fringes still. You know, it's not a mainstream activity by any stretch of the imagination.
I think it will be.
Yeah, I think it will. I think it will increasingly, as more things become mineable, i.e. they exist in the digital domain, then I think it will be, because simply people will be able to sell solutions rather than having to do the hard yards. And you raised a really interesting point, actually, which I didn't mention, which is, you know, that sort of valleys analogy is a good one. And I think that automation isn't necessarily a sort of purchasing category that's necessarily owned by IT. So I think you get a lot of decentralization in automation purchasing, particularly as like a lot of tools, CRMs, marketing automation platforms, whatever, have automation baked into them. So you get this really sort of decentralized view where automation capabilities are actually sat in the ownership of line of business. You know, roles like marketing, I think particularly, probably sit on quite a lot of the automation estate. And they're either underutilizing them because they don't have the capacity, resource, ability, whatever, to use them. Or maybe they are not underutilizing them, but they're only doing that through the sort of view of the valley of the silo that they're in, rather than having this kind of interdepartmental approach. And you know, as I'm sure we'll talk about as the episode continues, that's what you really need to have to do this effectively.
Yeah. So I guess moving on to what we're all about on the growth system, as normal, let's set it all in a systems context. And so what's actually going on from a sort of systems thinking point of view?
Okay. So there are quite a lot of ways into this one, because systems and processes are not exactly interchangeable, but certainly one of the fundamental kind of tenets of systems thinking theory is an entity must have a process and an operand. So it's kind of got this element of process baked into it. But I guess the best way to get into this is to really define the underlying problem behind the kind of static nature of most organizations' processes. And I think that on reflection, this is probably rooted in feedback loops. In the systems world, we talk a lot about feedback loops, which aren't actually, slightly confusingly, about feedback in the sort of commonly understood sense. Feedback loops, which can be balancing, they slow stuff down, reinforcing, they speed stuff up, can really be anything that has a material impact on the function of the system in question. And whatever the feedback, the reason most processes are fairly static is that the feedback simply isn't being received and acted on. And I think this is because most organizations fail to view processes as part of a sort of broader dynamic system, that when you view things holistically, like holism, we've talked about it a few times, right? We're not just trying to deconstruct. Then there are lots and lots of feedback loops waiting to be harnessed and understood. And these could be from loads of places, you know, from customers, or sales performance stats, conversion rate stats, NPS scores, you know, whatever. The list is long. And that's just thinking about the growth team as we are sort of, briefed to do here. But I think the job of whoever is running these processes is to draw a meaningful boundary around the problem and to take into account not just the sort of direct entities involved in the process, but the system context in which they sit. And I think that's a really, really key point here, is that we might look at feedback in a very, very zoomed in sense on processes. You know, is the bit of the process I own, is that doing the KPI that has been set? You know, single datum point really in terms of, is this thing working? Very, very seldom does anyone zoom out and even look about the whole process in terms of it, how it works end to end. You know, think about a customer journey through a business. I think that's a really, really good one to think about in the context of the growth team. You know, they're touching stuff out in the dark funnel. You know, how are we capturing signals on that? Where are they going? How are they traveling through our marketing estate to become first party data capture? You know, if they're becoming an opportunity, how's that being passed to sales? What does the sales process look like? What does the, you know, lead management process look like? What is the handover to pre-sales? You know, and so it goes on. That they're all so tempting to view those as sort of standalone processes, but the customer perspective is, I'm just traveling from I didn't know you to I'm now spending money with you. And that is a process, you know, that's a process that we call the customer journey, right? But no one actually thinks about it as a process. So thinking about those broader set of all the feedback loops that could be in there, you know, that is the big opportunity, I think. I think another big thing going on is this concept of reductionism that I kind of mentioned before. There is such a drive, almost a sort of cultural imperative, I think, to try and break problems down into the smallest number of parts possible. It's like a normal thing to do. I don't think people even really question it. In fact, I think they probably think of it as a smart way to address problems, which, okay, I'm not saying it's intrinsically not a smart way to address problems, but of course, when you do this, you lose sight of the big picture. You know, you don't see the forest for the trees. And that's an issue when we're talking about processes, particularly larger scale processes that touch things like a customer. So, you know, this is something that we're particularly prone to in the process design world, is kind of where if we focus, as I was just kind of saying, on one process or even one part of one process without taking into account the reality that most processes exist upstream and downstream from other related processes. And the opportunity here is to deliver what some people might call whole system optimization. And when you do this kind of, you know, I guess when you do the reverse, when you do a sort of entity level localized optimization, then you've got a huge risk factor. And that, in sort of sticking in systems thinking world, is that you give rise to a very common systems archetype, which is described as fixes that fail. I guess as with most of these archetypes, they're pretty self-explanatory, but briefly, it's the scenario where successfully, and I do stress the word successfully, fixing one thing in one part of the system has the unintended consequence of breaking something somewhere else in the broader system. It's what we sometimes call a second order effect. And that actually the net impact of fixing the one thing you were trying to fix is that you actually have a net negative impact in overall system performance. So, you know, that is something that the more zoomed in you are in your decision making, the more kind of reductionist you are in your thinking about processes, the more likely you are to break things without realizing them in the wider system context. And that is, I don't know, perhaps that's a risk factor. Maybe people intrinsically kind of inherently know this, so they don't change little things. I'm not sure. But in automation, although this isn't perhaps a literal interpretation of the fixes that fail archetype, I also think you can level a sort of criticism that actually just doing small fixes and sort of ignoring this big system-wide changes that are potentially available to you, you kind of get a fixes that fail from an opportunity cost perspective, because you're spending time, you know, mucking about in the weeds when you should be looking at an entirely different problem with the resource that you're expending on it. So to sum up, I guess, the systems thinking point of view is that set and forget as a problem arises because organizations treat processes in isolation. They sort of don't really consider how they fit into the larger organizational ecosystem, and automating particularly inefficient processes really compounds that. You sort of entrench the existing problems rather than using automation as an opportunity to reimagine and optimize the system as a whole. So it's that sort of fighting against the reductionist view, you know, taking that system-wide approach, you know, that's the opportunity.
Yeah, and I guess there needs to be someone or a function within organizing. I wouldn't be surprised if we started to see that sooner or later, especially after everyone hears the growth system and sees the light, where we might start to develop
roles
and functions, particularly within some of these complex enterprise organizations where this is the actual holistic focus. Right? Well, I'd like to see it happen anyway.
Absolutely. I think there's an interesting question about where that should actually sit as a role. Because I think when you come to process automation, there is a dichotomy at play, that because it's really tempting to put a big lumpy bit of automation, I think we're talking specifically about automation here, not just process design, which isn't necessarily the same thing, but you know, it's really tempting to stick that big IT investment with IT, because they're the guys that theoretically know how to run these things efficiently. They know how to do the governance. They maybe know how to write a little code if that's required. So it's a tempting place to put it. I think that we certainly see that causing backlog issues, because whilst all of those things are true, you've got two things going on, which is those people in IT are being pulled at in million different directions from, you know, requirements all over the organization, and they're not the subject matter experts. So I think that that is, you know, a recipe for bottlenecks. I think if we were to take a unsystematic view of the problem and think, well, within the growth team, the people I would want running the automation portfolio would be the RevOps team, because theoretically, if you have a proper RevOps team, they're transcending marketing, sales, and service account management, you know, quote to cash, you know, all the way really to revenue. So in the growth team, they're a great person to run automation. But I think I sort of increasingly starting to change my perspective on this. And actually, I think the true answer to nailing this down is actually through democratization of these resources. It's actually as things become increasingly no code, low code, that actually it's about creating a center of excellence within the organization for process design, and automation as a sort of byproduct of that. Because if you put the right structures in place, you put the right governance in place, you put the right release procedures in place, and we probably should do a whole episode actually, I think that'd be quite interesting, on sort of democratization of automation and sort of citizen automation, and there's lots of phrases for it. But I think if you can nail that bit, you can move so much faster and so much further by just putting more hands on the pump from the people that really know those processes. But you've just got to have that governance framework, so you always got the zoomed out view. So I think that's, you know, that's a really tough one, is how do you, as you say, how do you actually deliver this? Who actually delivers this effectively?
So in the meantime, until such roles and functions exist in this dreamy future, what can we do now to sort of practically guard against some of these issues, which again, like everything we covered on the growth system, seem to be endemic? I don't think I've worked anywhere that this wasn't a problem, apart from with you, obviously, Chris.
I think even here we are not without guilt in this respect. But nevertheless, I think to solve this, you need to take processes as dynamic parts of a larger system. You need to kind of reframe what a process is, and ensuring that process automation requirements are aligned with the entire system's evolving needs and goals. So how do you do that? I think in reality, you need to develop a kind of continuous improvement framework that sort of recognizes the interconnectedness of processes. It sort of embraces feedback loops. It uses automation as a tool for sort of broader system optimization rather than as simply for like efficiency gains in isolated workflows. So I think a lot of it's about a reframe of like where process design sits, even if that's just in your head rather than within the org. But yeah, broadly speaking, I would say there are six parts. What would they be? So I would say that it's about leaning into systems mapping and using that as a springboard for reimagining processes. So we have a proprietary process, which we could spend a very boring episode talking about, so we shouldn't do that. But ultimately, it's kind of like taking a three-step approach to system mapping. So it is understanding what is going on now in as broad a view of the system as is sensible to map. And that is about drawing the right boundaries and potentially then drawing multiple boundaries and doing the exercise multiple times and seeing the interfaces. But ultimately, mapping it as it is really, really key, because so often, I would say almost always, when we do this, and we do this day in, day out, almost certainly weekly on projects, it's the first time I think anyone's ever written this thing down and put it on a piece of paper. And you don't have to be an automation architect or an enterprise architect or even, you know, anything other than being vaguely familiar with the system. That once you stick this thing on a piece of paper, it actually becomes pretty obvious what the problems are. You just need to sort of do the hard yards in terms of writing them down. We then deliver what we term an opportunity impact assessment. And that is about looking at that as-is mapping of the system, whatever that system is, that process, and then saying, okay, well, where can we, you know, where are the problems that need to be solved? What are the likely solutions to those problems? How much effort and time is involved in fixing those problems? How much benefit is there to the business in fixing those things? So we would typically implement a sort of scoring system, a sort of index of impact, which would enable us to identify where the fixes need to be. And that would drive a 2B map, which effectively is the build brief for the next thing, the reimagining of what you're doing. And when you do this mapping, it's really important to not just map the entities in the system, the sort of nodes in the process, however you want to describe them, but the gold is buried in the interconnections. You know, we've said this before. I think actually in the very first episode, we talked about this a little bit. And when you map interconnections, it's really important to remember that interconnections have both form and function. And what I mean by that is form can take many forms, funny enough. it could be an API connection between two systems. It could be a carrier pigeon. It could be, you know, two people stood in a room talking and exchanging information once a week. All of those things are interconnections. So recognizing the form of the interconnection, the way that the information actually passes from point A to point B, that's really, really key. But also the function of that interconnection, you know, what is it actually there to do? You know, it might seem obvious, and very often it is obvious, but if there's an API connector and it moves five fields, you know, first name, last name, email address, whatever, from system A to system B, well, why is that actually happening? And I think that's a really, really important question to ask. Like, what is that facilitating? Why was it put there in the first place? Does it actually need to happen at all? You know, process design can be deconstructionist as well as constructionist. You know, it's not always additive. It can just be about taking the dead wood out. So why are these things happening? Why is this data passing form and function? I think another thing when you're doing the mapping exercise is to really consider dependencies within the system, contingencies, you know, what if something happens in step 27, you know, where did the data enter the process? You know, we need to make sure that we are understanding that there is a contingency between step 3 and step 27, you know. And I think that that's really, really important, because then you can then also do things like, if something entered at step three, what's it doing for the other 24 steps? Why is it there? Would it be more efficient for it to go from wherever it came to straight to step 27? So I think that's the sort of foundations of reimagining processes. I think the final thing with system mapping is really just that point about drawing boundaries. Because when we design a process, it's really tempting to draw a boundary around the process and then ignore everything outside the boundary. As we've already talked about, the context in which the process operates is often as important as the process itself. So where are those interfaces with the outside world? Sometimes very literally, you know, if you're designing a lead management process, there's probably quite a lot of interfaces with you know, tech stack that it exists outside the sort of, you know, the city walls of the business, whether that's something coming in from Google or some other point system or a partner or whatever, you know, there's a lot of context to consider quite often. And I said that was the final point. Actually, I'm probably thinking about it. The one thing I would think about actually in thinking about the opportunity impact assessment is, with our systems thinking hat still on, understanding what the system actually is doing, not just what it was supposed to do. So this is what we would call the emergent behavior of the system, because actually conducting a kind of variance analysis between what you thought it was going to do and what it's actually doing, and taking a view of what it's actually doing to not just be a sort of percentage of the intended output, like what else is it doing? Like, is it making people unhappy? Are the people that are responsible for TEP 26 thinking about leaving their jobs because they just can't be asked to do this thing every day anymore? You know, just, you could go on, but actually thinking about true emergent behavior, not just what pops out the other end, you know, that's really critical. So step one, you know, reimagining processes through systems mapping. So I think that, you know, that for me is definitely a big part of this, is getting that initial focus on what's going on. I think another sort of the next step, I guess, in this process, I'm starting to wish I hadn't started out by numbering, because I'm trying to struggle to remember exactly what I was going to say here. But but I would say
you were very sort of emphatic about how many there were and everything. I thought he's really got it mapped out in his head here, and now you've led yourself on a merry dance.
I sure have. Let's see how I do. You can see how close I get to six. So information access, I think, is another really big one in terms of building this kind of improvement framework. Number two, so continuous improvement is really a key objective of good kind of process improvement activities. And it would be really tempting, I think, to say that having switched on real-time data, that's going to be the facilitator of lots of continuous improvement. You know, continuous improvement implies we are going to continually be changing stuff. That absolutely should not be the case. You know, making lots of small changes very quickly is typically a dreadful idea. It sounds like a great idea. You know, we're always on the front foot, we're always optimizing. But you know, experience tells us that the emergent behavior of systems is obviously very often very delayed. You know, it only actually reveals itself over time, and that emergent behavior can be positive behaviors or it can be negative behaviors. And you kind of need to let the edge cases reveal themselves, you know. We talk about this a lot in kind of automation architecture, of not just designing for the happy path, you know, when everything goes right, you know, when every API call is returned and every field was filled in the right formatting. It's, you know, what happens when, you know, someone wrote it all lowercase and backwards and didn't fill in this field and whatever else has happened. You know, you need to give it time to break almost, so you can really understand the true performance. And another thing, and it's not something we've talked about a lot before, but there's this concept of oscillation in systems that relates to delays. And the more quickly you change stuff, the more likely you are to create oscillation. And oscillation typically is sort of negative, in the sense that we just get this sort of bounce back effect. You know, we make a little change, like the butterfly effect, and, you know, a storm starts somewhere else. Well, it's kind of the same, I think, with process design. And we need to not, do many two flaps of the wings before we really see what's happening in the system. I think another thing with this sort of path to sort of continuous improvement is actually just never assuming anything's ever going to work as you intended it to. I think it's always a really good mindset to be in. It sounds flippant, but
pessimist never disappointed.
Absolutely. I say this frequently, speaking as a card carrying pessimist. Yeah. I mean, the always monitoring that sort of broadest view of the system that you can sensibly track and just looking for where it's going wrong. I mean, ultimately, I think that's why we provide a lot of value to our customers, is probably because we take that view of the world, and therefore things that we build typically, I'm actually not going to say that, but things tend to work because you're putting the hard yards in. So let's try number three. I think I'm on track now. Number point three in kind of building this framework of how we do it properly is focusing on whole system optimization. I mentioned it earlier. You know, try not to have that task mindset. Have a system mindset, have a process mindset, a growth mindset. People call it different things, but ultimately have a mindset where you think about the system as a whole, and your intention when you start playing with the processes is to optimize the performance of the big system, not the small part of it or the bit where you see the problem. And that is, you know, I mentioned it earlier, I think it's really true. It's just like the change doesn't need to happen necessarily in the org. It doesn't need to be a role for this. You need to change a mindset. Like, you need to change how you're thinking about solving problems. If step three and four are manual, don't just plug it with an automation. Or if you do just plug it with an automation, make sure you've zoomed right out and thought about what that means, and crucially, what it could mean, and what was the opportunity cost of only thinking small. If we're taking that resource out, could we use that as an opportunity for a wider reimagining? And being aware of those kind of second order effects. So having a broad view of measurement and collaborating with a lot of stakeholders system wide when you're making changes, because ultimately that's going to add insight and it's going to remove risk, because you're just going to know more about what could happen and what has happened after you've done it. So I think instead of sort of looking at automation as a means for improving individual tasks or processes, you know, a systems thinking approach is thinking about that broad system view, and looking kind of beyond the immediate gains of fixing the little thing and thinking about fixing the big thing. Next up, I would go with sort of making sure that we build flexibility into the processes that we are automating. Now, this is so much easier than it used to be. A good systems thinking first solution, I guess, is one that has a lot of flexibility for optimization. You know, it allows processes to be easily adjusted and kind of reconfigure as business needs evolve, as you learn more, as those second order effects kind of present themselves. So it, not so very long ago, I mean, you and I both remember it well, things like iPaaS tools where you just, you know, clicked some buttons and two systems connected to each other, that was fantasy land. Like there were people that were hard to talk to that you had to explain what you wanted and why you wanted, and then code had to be written and deployed and hosted somewhere and tested. And
probably had to hire the team to build the integration first.
Exactly
and
that.
And then wait a few months.
Exactly that. And that created a lot of like rigid structures. It created a lot of fragility in the practices. It also created a massive disincentive to ever changing stuff. But nowadays, by implementing, we mentioned Waccato earlier, you know, we love Waccato, implementing a really good iPaaS tool, having a somewhat democratized use of it, having that sort of system-wide view means that straight away you can, not necessarily should, but you can go and change things really easily. You can really understand how it's working. You can debug them really easily. And taking that kind of agile view of how you fix processes, particularly with an automation lens on that problem, that's a really, really important point. And I guess as a sort of extension of that point, I'm going to call this point five. I think that it's really important to kind of identify the leverage points when you're building automation. you know, when you're actually doing that architecture at the start, that we need to look at before the architecture, probably. We don't need to think about, well, how is system, you know, the data in system A going to end up in system Z, and what steps is it going to go through? It's actually thinking about the business problem that's trying to be solved and understanding the leverage points available to you within the systems landscape that are going to most easily solve that problem. So, you know, instead of kind of automating or designing processes indiscriminately, you know, focus on the high leverage point areas where automation can produce the greatest impact on overall system performance, and use that as the sort of foundational blocks of your enterprise architecture, of your solution architecture, because ultimately you're going to get closer to those business goals faster if you take that view, not just on the data movement, but on the business impact, and kind of having that holistic understanding of how processes are interconnected in a way which creates business value is where you're going to lead to those big improvements. But also, and we've talked about this quite often, you know, fixing systems is about identifying leverage points. If you identify those leverage points against the business requirements first, you know the levers to pull. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to know which direction to pull the levers in any better straight away, but you certainly know where they are. You know, you've got the control panel. And taking that sort of improvement view, that continuous improvement view, you know, you don't have to think about the problem too much at that point. You know, you can start thinking about what the test program is going to be almost at the start. And I think that's a really good way to kind of unlock positive emergent benefit.
I think if you do that, sorry to interrupt, Chris, I was just thinking that if you follow this sort of systems thinking approach, identifying the high leverage points, and you execute on that well, presumably that's going to create a sort of virtuous circle where future holistic strategic automation efforts are going to be much easier to get stakeholders to buy into, and the process keeps sort of improving there.
Yeah, thank you for that, because you've actually reminded me of what the point six was, so I've done it.
Do you know, I wouldn't be surprised if you decide that there's seven and they actually called it wrong at the start. Well done, you've got to six.
Yes, this was probably ill-advised. You can tell that this clearly isn't rehearsed as a podcast. So I think the final one is that stakeholder piece that you mentioned. It's involving those cross-functional teams to be part of that process reimagination point, you know, at the start. It's to have those people around the table when you identify the levers we were just talking about, because you're going to identify them so much quicker. You're going to get that sort of buy-in from cross-functional collaboration. You know, you're doing something not because of a top-down directive, but you're doing something in a way that genuinely involves those stakeholders, because they're there in the architecture. You know, you might not call it architecture because they're probably line of business people that's not going to be a meeting they're going to want to turn up to, but actually treating it from the perspective of problem solving, treating it from the perspective of the levers, you know, that's a great way to kind of view the world and view the problem solving process. And it's going to give you that best understanding of the system in its entirety, you know, the process in its entirety, the up and downstream effects, call them what you will. And it's going to help you identify the inefficiencies. You know, I talked in point one about the opportunity impact assessment. Well, the as-is mapping is driven by a great conversation, which gives you the leverage points to then talk about the opportunity impact assessment. You know, having that cross-functional view of that process is something that is going to give you a fantastic starting point to start doing your process design from, doing your automation design from. And, you know, I think, perhaps as a final point, you know, systems thinking teaches us that problems typically arise in silos. You know, they arise when you allow silos to exist. And, you know, you've got to get out the silo. You know, you've got to get into that world of cross-functional collaboration. You've got to get into that world of, you know, mapping and driving understanding and understanding where the levers are to really efficiently start delivering, you know, change, you know, meaningful change within the organization. And by having that human view, by having that collaborative view, I think you can actually remove the inertia to change, because you're not thinking about an SOP or a fragile set of automations that's going to be fixed, which sounds like a pain, it sounds like an IT challenge. You're thinking about business value, you're thinking about where to pull the levers. And I think that's a much greater impetus for change, because you are writing the business case in conversation to go do it. And I think that's how you create a culture of transformation within the organization. So there we go. Did it.
And you're confident still that there's six, yeah? Yeah, you don't want to add in another one or anything. So you're just telling me that you had that cold from the beginning. Okay, and it amazes me that you managed to get through that last point without using the word alignment.
I did, didn't I? Yes.
This is a first.
There's going to be some angry people out there if they printed out the bingo cards.
Well, I've said it now, so the bingo card can be marked. We are actually close enough to time that I'm going to call it, unless you think that there is another, if there is a seventh, no, you're confident in the sixth. I think we're going to call it on time here and go to kind of final thoughts. I think you could probably do with a break after your six points there. So at the risk of getting ideas above my station, or maybe kind of go to my outtakes. The big one for me, I think it's just not thought about enough, but like all great ideas, seems really obvious when somebody says it to you, is that people aren't utilizing this tool of systems mapping. I think one thing that really hit the nail on the head for me was when you said the problems, it becomes obvious what the problem is. Diagnosis becomes very easy generally when we actually map out the system to understand the interconnections and we realize where the gold is. And I think by really thoroughly mapping out how the processes interact within the whole organization and not just within a silo, within your valley, I think we can really identify these leverage points, the kind of best leverage point to have the most impact and kind of avoid that sort of unintended consequences, butterfly effect from isolated changes. Mm-hmm. And that's a really interesting topic in itself to dive into. And I guess if you have that in line with a mentality that is about recognizing in advance the risks of automation without redesigning, like virtually every automation or probably more so integration projects, which are sometimes misnamed as automation projects, it's very much in the kind of opposite mindset to this, where like we have a process just now, it's manual, it's annoying. I feel like the pain enough to do something about it. So let's just automate that process. And then you lock in the inefficiency and possibly even sort of have a net negative effect. So I think it's really important to kind of, it brings us back to this whole system optimization point that you were making. And that, I guess, brings me to something that you mentioned earlier on, which is about adopting this strategic approach to automation procurement. So just try to sort of centralize or at least make it a cross-functional initiative to actually not have sort of siloed solutions. And you're right, I'm going to call out marketers here as well, or marketing departments here for having endless sort of stream of technical debt built up from point to point connections that I've seen in the past. I'd always just have to get a dig in at marketers before I finish off. But yeah, I'm going to leave my final thoughts for there. Curious to know what your outtakes from this were.
Well, I just did a fairly long list, so I think perhaps I won't subject the listeners to another long list. But I would say just two general outtakes, which is, when you are thinking about solving a process problem or doing a process improvement project, zoom out as far as makes sense and think about what role does this process play in the broader stack of processes and what is the actual business purpose that is trying to be achieved there, particularly if that touches a customer. You know, what is the customer imperative here? And, you know, let that guide the process. And as a sort of related point is, don't think about it as a technology or even a, you know, we are just purely talking about human processes here. You know, I do this, then I do that, which is still absolutely fine. Automation is not the answer to everything. Then still absolutely think about it from a people and business problems perspective first, and leave the, you know, sticks and boxes to somewhat further down the process, when you've really, really understood the problem at hand, the benefits that are in prospect, and use that as the jumping off point for starting to do that sort of mapping exercise that we discussed.
Yeah, I think rather than simplifying things by being too reductionist, that type of mentality actually does kind of cut through the noise quite nicely. Well, I think we're just about at time. Mm-hmm. We are indeed. I'm going to call it there. I think it's been a really rich topic, but for me, once again, it's really just opened up a whole bunch of other potential topics that we're going to have to dive into on future sessions, and in some cases, maybe even get a guest or two on to chat about. Who knows?
Yeah, I hope you're taking notes of these extra things, because I know I'm not. But
yes, I am. Well, that's pretty much all we've got time for this week. The Growth System is brought to you by RevSpace, an applied growth consultancy that connects B2B organizations with the future of growth, offering consultancy, education, and applied delivery services. So don't forget to follow and rate the podcast. It really helps us to bring the content to a wider audience, and we'd really appreciate a moment of your time to tell us what you think. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening.
See you again next week.